This is side two of session 20, October 16, 2006, and we're continuing with Scott commenting on this long LaRouche passage that we're still reading through. You were saying that...
Yeah, well, he's talking about this sort of gradient of going from the plurality of Egyptian and Greek gods to the monotheism. And that process must be like a singularity that can, you know, that
subsumes. If you're going to subsume all these quarreling gods, you've got to go into something that's not even on the same playing field.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It is the process he's talking about. It's the creator that cannot be reached, but it is a lawful process. We're trying to see more and more and better.
Yeah.
Produce products that approximate that.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's kind of sort of like the interval. You don't get to visualize the interval.
Yeah, which means it's really incorrect to even try to use the word God, because you can't put a noun on a process that's an infinite process that has no ultimate completion.
Right, so I like LaRouche's way of being a Christian is to think in this processual manner.
Yeah.
It counters getting solidified into an idea of one God.
Yeah. But the paradox is that if there's no final place that one can arrive at called God, because it's an eternal process, then there can't be one thing. And we're talking about monotheism. We're saying there's one thing, but there's no thing to be
to be one about. That's right, but LaRouche talks a lot about paradox.
Mm-hmm.
And what appears to be paradox at this phase is not a paradox at a later development, a later evolution.
Uh-huh. So where did I leave off in this paragraph?
As corroborated by...
Yeah,
said, okay.
That's what I thought. As corroborated by Manetho's king lists for Egypt, the victorious... Scalawags of that ancient Moroccan strife employed their maritime culture to colonize regions of the Mediterranean, imposing the worship of their ancestors and associated mythologies upon the credulous subjects of those colonies.
They get bogged down. They evolved from the maritime culture to being colonizers around the Mediterranean, imposing concrete gods on them.
Mm-hmm.
Losing the Platonic process.
Mm.
The Hesiodic is how you say it.
Hesiodic pantheon was evil enough. The substratum upon which that pantheon is superimposed embodies the essential evil, the anti-logos principle. The substratum is the Chaldean Philistine system associated with the worship of earth goddess Shakti, Ishtar, Isis, and Sabel, and her phallic symbol sun, Shiva, Osiris, Satan, Dionysus, and also with the third male figure, Horus, Lucifer, Apollo, etc. This substratum is the irrationalistic, hedonistic doctrine of, quote, blood and soil, unquote.
Blood and soil, which was the cults of Russia and Germany in World War II.
Oh. So he's really putting down this idea of the earth goddess, huh?
Yeah.
New Age thinking, we have to encompass the idea of Gaia, the earth mother, along with the possibility of the sky father god, because otherwise it's a one-sided, lopsided, patriarchal system.
Yeah, and so LaRouche is proposing that that's not... You're reacting to a patriarchal. LaRouche's solution is never to react with an alternative solution, because you're either being a Polynesian and Dionysian in a rigged game. You go around it, through it, past it, with the interval of the conceptual dialectic. So
mm-hmm.
LaRouche, and now Thompson will sort of represent the new Age thinking that you were just referring to.
Well, LaRouche doesn't want to include the idea of the feminine within the idea of the Godhead?
No, because he says we're human beings, and we shouldn't lock ourselves into categories of being male or female.
Well, he probably thinks of God as being...
Well, this is what we're going to find out. He's going to talk about it in this section. This is where we're going to get into. Let's see how he tries to talk himself out of this
together
blatant, imbalanced state of mind where he doesn't appreciate ISIS.
Okay. Together, the Hesiodic sort of pantheon and the substratum define the characteristic theology of oligarchical culture. The Hesiodic pantheon symbolizes the capricious tyrannies of a degraded, squabbling collection of families of ancient, quote, jet-set, unquote. The philosophical world outlook congruent with such ordering of society is the degraded belief structure exemplified by the cult of Isis, Osiris, and Horus.
And remember, this is a Christian view, because Isis, Osiris, Horus are the pagan cults that Christ repudiated.
Did Jesus repudiate those?
Well, nowadays people say no, he didn't. But for 2,000 years under visual space, it appeared that he was repudiating the Aristotelian.
The contrast between the Promethean man of Judeo-Christian monotheism and the degraded man in the altering images of Apollo and Dionysus is paradigmatic for the deeper study of cultures. The first approximates a culture based on the principle of good. The latter culture is based on the principle of evil. The development of mankind according to the ordering principle provided by the first coincidences with...
No, by the first, coincide.
By the first...
The development of mankind according to the ordering principle provided by the first coincides...
With the cited injunction of the Book of Genesis, mankind must, quote, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it, unquote. The fulfillment of this injunction is measured as increase of potential relative population density. The study of advances in technology by means of which this injunction is fulfilled compels us to probe the principles of discovery common to successive advances in technology. This obliges us to advance toward discovery and mastery of the notion of the hypothesis of the higher hypothesis. You know, that sounds like a singularity in and of itself. The hypothesis of the higher hypothesis is probably an infinite process.
Yeah. Well, the lawful process is towards a negentropic singularity.
Yeah. The more you get drawn into an infinite process, the faster you get drawn into it. The more you get drawn into it, the faster you get drawn into it. It probably is an accelerating, probably accelerates towards this singularity or this aha that maybe... process.
Right, but you don't get stuck in that. LaRouche is going to not... He talks about the bad series of infinity.
Oh, bad series of infinity.
Yeah, that's a philosophical concept.
Wow. Good is the principle of beauty and love akin to the joy of a child in discovering new knowledge to replace earlier beliefs.
Yeah, now good is not, you know, Madonna or whatever you think is a beautiful woman or a beautiful guy.
Mm-hmm.
It is the joy of thought, discovering new knowledge to replace earlier beliefs. See? There's a distinction there. It's not embedded in the senses.
Mm-hmm.
It's the aha experience, not the final aha experience, just the ongoing many aha experiences.
Mm-hmm.
So read that again with that in mind.
Good is the principle of beauty and love, akin to the joy of a child in discovering new knowledge to replace earlier beliefs. Joy and beauty are a world of such surprises, a world of ironies which are beautiful because they are lawful. This beauty is a sense of this italicized freedom. Not freedom to violate the law, but freedom to discover the limitless advancement of human knowledge and of the human condition available to mankind through mastery of the law.
The law of the hypothesis of the higher hypothesis.
Evil is the principle of the wicked child's rage against the parents who threaten to, quote, interfere with the impulses of the infantile, irrationalistic hedonism. Evil is, therefore, essentially hateful against reason and all that reason implies. It is the Dionysian terrorist hatred against reason and against the urban culture which destroys the bestial freedom of fang and claw of the wilderness. Evil is Friedrich Nietzsche and
Dostoevsky.
Yeah. Good in culture is the rule of Prometheans over the Apollonians. Apollonians and Dionysians. Good in the individual is the subjugation of evil of infantilism within himself. the enslavement of the Apollo and Dionysus within oneself. On this account, the good, that's capital letter good, culture is, quote, authoritarian in the hate-filled eyes of the Nazi follower of Nietzsche or Dostoevsky. How does he say his name?
Dostoevsky.
What is it?
Dostoevsky.
Dostoevsky.
In other words, and then he says, quote, authoritarian because
it represents reason's, quote, suppression of infantile bestiality, irrationalism by reason. To all good men, a society according to the model of Sparta, the freedom of the beast unleashed in the form of man, is an evil tyranny from which mankind must be liberated. So evil modern men like Nietzsche hate Friedrich Schiller, hate Socrates, and are determined to eradicate from culture the image of Jesus Christ as Adolf Hitler was so determined. Human culture is primarily the struggle of, quote, of good, capital good, to eradicate capital evil from this world. It is not a Manichaean struggle to be foreseen as alternate periods of rule by Apollo and Dionysus over endless errors.
Yeah, let's just stop there. That's the cliche idea that the pendulum swings back and forth through a period of conservatism, that's Apollonian, and then back to a period of release and liberalism, Dionysius. You know, pendulum is an oligarchic model which reason goes past.
Right. Now, I happen to know that you're a big fan of Frank Zappa, who was Apollonian and Dionysian, so you've got a lot of explaining to do here, Bob.
Well, he works in the tactile interval. He plays with both and is neither, like LaRouche and McLuhan and Thompson and Croker and myself.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Zappa's a tactile musician.
Yeah. But like you say, he plays with both. And here LaRouche doesn't sound like he plays with both. He plays with
something else altogether.
Well, with reason, but he abhors this rebellion against reason.
That's right. Yeah. As a matter of fact, often when I was with Zappa, I'd end up talking to his subordinates, the guys who worked with him in his studio, and they often were spouting off statements, well, I'm a rationalist. I believe in reason.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had picked up, I was assuming they were, except for Frank, but they were reasonable. And so that just shows you, behind the scenes, Frank was a man of reason.
Mm-hmm.
Same ideology as LaRouche, even though he dealt with music that LaRouche didn't think was worth the time of day. But if you notice, Zappa does turn it into another level.
He does.
Beethovenizes it, Brahmsies it, Bach's it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, Mozart's that's true.
It.
Yeah.
But that is what LaRouche defines in earlier articles, that the method of the real teacher is to take the pagan culture and turn it into something new.
Yeah. I think the thing that LaRouche is missing here is that when reason goes astray and creates systems that don't work, then you need the rebellious Nietzschean type character to come in and sort of destroy that faulty system built on faulty reason in order to be able to clear the way for possibly creating a truer.
What was the last word?
Something to create a something truer.
Yeah, but see, it's that the oligarchs know that they're going to get rebels. That's why they allow their young princes and their oligarchs to sow their wild oats. And, you know, the young kids, the princes and princesses of the oligarchs and rich people always get to play around for a couple of decades before they have to settle down and take over their father's job, right?
Yeah.
See, that's embedded in a sensory reaction to whatever they think authority is. There's another way LaRouche is pointing to that doesn't get caught in the game of rebelling and then being corrected. You'll see it in folk cultures that people will supposedly sin when they're young and then become very conservative, strict, authoritarian repenters. And that's swinging back on a pendulum within the senses and never even engaging the realm of reason, which is not reason as tyrannical Newtonian science or modern science. It is reason as the freedom to think and to break through the models and assumptions around you and not be embedded in the sensory dialectic.
Mm-hmm.
That's what he's trying to get at. Now, if you go back and read the quotes that we read months ago, you will find that's what he's saying.
Mm-hmm.
but he's calling it reason here. See, so you have to not romanticize the rebellion. LaRouche is the ultimate rebel, but he doesn't rebel with an idea of falling into a trap. He stays on course. He says the oligarchs are the rebels because they stay embedded in the technologies we have and don't allow the development of new breakthroughs.
Mm-hmm.
And reason would move to know that there's more technologies. We would never say we're at the greatest period of development, as the oligarchs usually always say.
Yeah. Well, the reason why we stay with the same structures is because we get a little complacent and we like the security and of having a concrete ground to stand on.
Right.
When you're always developing the new, then the ground is always shifting under your feet and it's uncomfortable.
Yes, and therefore you're always being a rebel if you're in that realm of LaRouchean groundlessness.
Yeah.
Why react to one thing and call that rebellion?
Mm-hmm.
Why not rebel against the solidification? In other words, support what is good and use that to create a new version of what could be good.
Right.
Rather than say, well, I'm going to go the other way. I'm going to go in the mirror.
Mm-hmm.
Because the mirror was set up by an inferior culture.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, let's just go to how he tries to talk about it.
Okay.
So he's going to talk about this struggle.
The culture, would you say the culture of the mirror is the culture of the visual space?
Yeah, but every sense is a mirror, so let's not get bogged down in
All right, so I'm going to continue on here.
Yeah, he's laid out that the normal cliche way of rebellion is not the way to go. So now he's going to try to define how you do rebel.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And it's going to have to be a process.
Well, it is a struggle to eradicate.
Now, human culture, where are we at?
Well, I just read it is not a Manichaean struggle to be foreseen as alternate periods of rule by Apollo and Dionysus over endless eras.
No, wait. Okay, we just said as Adolf Hitler was so determined. Now, the next human culture is primarily. Have we read that?
Yeah, but I'll just start from there.
Because
we've been digressing. Human culture is primarily the struggle of good to eradicate evil from this world. It is not a Manichaean struggle to be foreseen as alternate periods of rule by Apollo and Dionysus over endless eras. It is a struggle to eradicate evil from culture and to eradicate, therefore, cultures which are evil. It is, at the same time, a struggle to define the process by which the evil of the newborn infant, that infant's irrationalistic hedonism, is brought under the control of and ultimately destroyed by the spark of the divine, a potential for reason in that same infant.
See, it's the potential for reason, which
yeah.
is the process of good.
Yeah. It is in that latter respect that the principles of culture, as we have thus far described those principles, determine what is more or less conventionally identified by the term culture in scholarly opinion. Culture is the elaboration of a principle. Which principle is more or less good or evil? To shape both the education of the infant, child, and adolescent in society, and to shape also the body of ideas of practice which the adults employ to educate the young. Culture is essentially the development of the potentialities of the new individual, essentially through his or her 16th to 18th birthday, as Wilhelm von Humboldt's program for primary and secondary education addresses this principle. Otherwise, culture is the developing body of ruling ideas. According to this principle, which governs the aggregate practice of a society composed of individuals whose potentials have been developed in that way.
Otherwise, culture is the developing body of ruling ideas according to this principle, which governs the aggregate practice of a society composed of individuals whose potentials have been developed in that way.
Mm-hmm.
That's like it causes itself to become.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The general approach required for a science of culture applies the conceptions we have thus far developed to the outline afforded by Dante's Commedia, together with other writings focused upon the same issues. What culture is measured first by finding the place on the, quote, ladder of the Commedia on which the culture is located, and at the same time determining whether the motion of that culture is up or down the ladder. End of...
long quote.
Long quote.
And just the next quote, I'll just read the first sentence from the next quote. It follows from this. Is it from the same essay? It's another long one, and it goes, no, it's, yes, it's from the same thing. So that's why the latter metaphor is continued. The next quote says, a fixed culture is at once characterized by codes of conduct which are on relatively higher or lower rungs of the ladder as codes of conduct by the group within society, such that a group within the lower rungs of purgatory of this sort is to be preferred to such a group on the rungs of the inferno. So, anyways, he's using the ladder, continues the ladder metaphor, and that is pages, that's a few pages later from what we just read, which is pages 42, 43, and 44. So, are you seeing any common patterns, or is it just too complex?
Well, what he was saying was getting clearer as I was going along, but I'm having a hard time relating it to what I began with, like, an hour ago, because we've covered so much ground.
Well, you know, he's talking about the infantilist, childish, hedonistic child, kid.
Right.
That is, like, the first level. That's the simple hypothesis. We go back to where our quotes were. We define simple hypothesis, and then higher hypothesis, and then the hypothesis of the higher hypothesis. Simple hypothesis is the normal kid embedded in sensate reality.
Mm-hmm.
Higher hypothesis is someone beginning to get ideas or principles, but remains in the Apollonian or Dionysius, which is struggling with the hedonistic nature of the infant. You either have a firm, stiff upper lip and don't fall for its guiles, or you wallow in them.
Yeah.
So the second level is reacting to the first simple hypothesis, early childhood's hedonism. But the third mature Platonic level, what he calls the Promethean or Promethean, is something that is not wrestling with the hedonistic. It recognizes the value and liveliness of thought and creative activity, which is way more sensuous than what people think is sensuous.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's the paradox here.
Yeah, he's saying that this joy and beauty cannot be found, say, in the body, but in maybe the interval between the body and the...
Right, and it's not in the given. It is in the process of unfolding new discoveries and new expressions of that through new technologies.
Yeah.
Now, that's common sense.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the... inventor or Western or cultural progress notion of common sense.
Yeah. On the world stage right now, it looks like Kim Jong-il is sort of the infantile hedonistic, guy who's rebelling against...
the authority.
The authority and wants to develop not new technology, but he wants to develop old destructive technology.
Yeah, he does not want to be... He can say, look, we have the right as a sovereign nation to develop our own technology, which on a general level, LaRouche would support. LaRouche often supports the bad guys, like Iraq, and I don't know if he supports North Korea, probably not, but he supported Iraq in the war. He was against the Bush wars, both of them.
Yeah.
He's very involved with the peace movement, but they were too intellectual for the normal, rabble that were involved in peace, the normal rebellion, anti-authoritarian people who had no program to counter that, just like the Democrats have no program to counter the oligarchical effect of the Republican Party. So but the national sovereignty principle is what LaRouche supports, but he doesn't believe in reacting in a silly, immature, nihilistic, Nietzschean form of rebellion, which is what he would categorize as counterculture, Bob Dylan, Elvis, and rock culture, the sex, drugs, and rock and roll culture, is not going to offset the problem. And so where LaRouche sees always a complicity between North Korea or bin Laden and the Bush administration. He always sees them working together because it fits in his model that the oligarchs take advantage of the apparent authoritarian dictator and those who react against him. They play the two against each other.
Mm-hmm.
So LaRouche wouldn't support North Korea in a knee-jerk, simple manner. He would see how North Korea is being prodded by the Bush people or by whoever, the oligarchs, to create a problem that distracts everybody from the program of reason.
Mm-hmm.
So he would see the North Korean guy and Bush in cahoots at some level.
Yeah. Or they might be, North Korea might be to some degree a puppet of China.
Or it could even be a puppet of a certain part of the intelligence agencies in the Pentagon because they want to have a bit of a terror program going on in October before the election.
Huh. Yeah.
So it's really the program of reason is you got an argument going on around you. You don't get heated up and take one side or the other. You try to reconcile the differences. And one of the ways to do that is pull the rug out from what seems to be the assumptions of those having the argument and point out to them, hey, you're missing something else that's going on around you. That's what McLuhan does. So people get involved in the content arguments of media and don't notice the effects of the medium form itself.
Mm-hmm.
LaRouche is doing the same method in another way, operating in the interval, but emphasizing ongoing technological breakthroughs, which are not only just in the lab, but in poetry and music and education and geometry and astronomy and the whole realm of culture.
Mm-hmm.
He's covering the whole spectrum here. And so he jumps from one specialist topic to another.
Well, I've heard him state that he believes that that Bush is clinically insane.
Yeah.
Now, that sounds like the statement of infantile irrationalism.
Right.
That's a rebellious infantilism to make a statement to that at that extreme.
That's right. No, LaRouche is. I remember when LaRouche was on Larry King, and Mae Brussel was shocked at how calm and reasonable LaRouche was on Larry King on the TV show because he was so used to these hysterical headlines in their newspaper,
mm-hmm.
The New Solidarity, or maybe it was called the New Federalist before that. You know, these screaming headlines, he thought LaRouche would be a maniac on TV.
Mm-hmm.
But LaRouche, you have to look at how newspapers and political newspapers like his organs are meant to be journalistic and inflammatory. But it doesn't mean that he is.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, you bring in McLuhan, you have a different style for a different media. So LaRouche knew enough to be cool on TV.
Mm-hmm.
LaRouche could be charged being infantile, but if you ask him to explain his program, let's say, you know, the little kid is yelling, screaming, demanding to be heard, okay, so you shut up and let the kids say their bit. They ain't going to come up with much. We are reading hours of what LaRouche is explaining is the right way to go, and when he screams and we decide to give him a break for a few minutes and let him make a fool of himself and explain his program, we find out that his program is pretty articulate, which is the purpose of me providing these quotes, just like you went through. You were quite amazed at the complexity or the thoughtfulness of what LaRouche said.
Yeah.
Even though he appeared in the media to be insane.
Well,
hedonistic.
A little while ago, you asked if I saw any overarching patterns in all of the stuff that we've covered tonight, which maybe you could... going back to the beginning, just scan through what we have read and bring this pattern into high relief so we can see how it does all tie together.
Yeah, we did. We did 12 pages.
Yeah.
Okay, so we began with music. Now, the particulars. Sometimes it's hard to figure out what he's saying in the particulars. Like, if we begin with the first statement that we started with on page 46, he says, themes in music are as lines to a poet. Okay, so he's going to show the bridge between music and literacy, or poetry. And he says, the themes in music are as lines to a poet. They are musical ideas. Now, musical ideas is italicized, meaning that they're not musical ideas. They are something different than music per se. And what they are is the theme that the musician is working, the real musician, the Platonic musician, is working with the same themes as the poet. So what are musical ideas italicized, right? You see what I'm saying?
What does it mean when LaRouche or McLuhan italicizes words? It means that they don't mean the words in the literal sense.
Yeah.
So they have to italicize them to say that they're actually trying to say something else. Or what does that mean?
Right. It's usually moving the emphasis to another level.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you have to italicize to make the sense. You're emphasizing something that is more than what the paragraph has emphasized, so you have to flip it to another level.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, in another meaning, it's just overemphasizing it. It's like trying to put oral intonation. They are musical ideas,
mm-hmm.
rather than just musical ideas.
Well, now, what is the distinction between italicizing and putting quotes around, or do they both achieve the same effect?
No, putting quotes is you're quoting someone else.
Well, no, quoting cliches, yeah.
When you put something in italics, you are emphasizing a multi-leveled, almost you could say a multi-sensuous tactile level. It's another level of trying to break through and create a kind of ESP.
Well, if you're quoting cliches, what you're saying is, I'm using this word in the, quote, conventional sense. But
yeah.
Don't be fooled, because I really mean something else.
That's right. In other words, don't get lost in the noun.
Yeah.
And also, musical ideas, he's saying they are musical ideas. You can't hear ideas.
No.
That's an oxymoron.
Contradiction.
Musical ideas. I mean, you can't hear.
Well, sure you can. If you're a composer, you hear the music, and you transliterate it into putting notes on the page.
The receiver begins not as a composer. The composer hopes that one can get to that level.
Mm-hmm.
But they are musical ideas.
I'm sure there's grammar to music. You know, there's, if you learn to read and write music, you discover there's this grammar to it, a syntax, a structure, it's a language.
Right, but you don't get stuck in the language. So when he says musical ideas, he's saying something beyond the apparent words. It's something to be discovered.
Mm-hmm.
Themes in music are as lines to a poet. They are musical ideas. I would assume he's trying to show that they are not embedded in the sense. They're not embedded in the senses.
Mm-hmm.
They are musical ideas. It's almost like when you're having a conversation and you're coming to a key point that two people are trying to match on. You'll find that they overemphasize each other, the exactitude, but then once they agree on it, the next day they might not remember how to say what they agreed on.
Mm-hmm.
You get to that level of thought that LaRouche is always talking about.
Yeah, so it's kind of like Plato's ideals.
Yeah, yeah. They are musical ideas, even on the level of primitive culture's comprehension of music. Even in the primitive cultures are groping. A theme must parse. It must have the preconscious. See, preconscious, you don't fully get it. But it's also the effects preceding the causes. Your preconscious is determining what you're working towards. It's what he says later. It causes it to become. Causes it to become.
Mm-hmm.
If it's going to become something, how does it know what to cause it to become?
Yeah. Well, what happens when a woman's in labor? This process occurs, and once the process begins, the more the process begins, the more it happens, until finally the birth occurs.
Yeah.
But you could think of the child in the womb as being the sort of preconscious process, and then it finally gives birth to the child to the light of day.
Yes. No, that's good. He says later, it causes itself to become. Well, how does it know what it's to become if it hasn't become it yet? To cause itself to become. He says, it adopts the self-reflexive transitive form of itself. So it's aware of It's like the woman knows what to do to give birth.
Yeah. When you think about the development of the fetus, well, what's causing that to happen? It seems to be causing itself to happen anyway.
Yeah, it follows a lawfulness that we're still trying to understand.
Yeah.
Or we claim we do understand it completely now. Now we can start cloning it.
Well, even if we can clone it, doesn't mean that we totally understand the process. It just means that we can initiate the process outside of the womb.
Yeah. So a theme must parse. It must have the preconscious form of a musical idea utterance. It has to have the form of a thought, such that the mind seizes that utterance as a gestalt. The mind thinks it, sees what it wants to become, something corresponding to a musical idea statement in and for itself. The process of composition then presents the mind with an ambivalence, because it's got to work towards what it's intuited, but it hasn't got there yet. I'm saying that. The process of composition then presents the mind with an ambivalence. Each of the musical idea statements subsumed in the developmental process is at first glance an ordinary musical idea statement. It's like a noun, but it's got to be verbalized, made into a verb. Yet it is also essentially something else, a mere predicate of the developmental process, whose meaning is essentially the latter. So it's a stage of the process, and the developmental process is the meaning that's later to become. It is the polemical struggle within the mind between the two kinds of meaning, which is the musical experience of the audience. So this doubleness that McLuhan talks about, LaRouche is getting at, there's a doubleness going on, or a paradox.
Mm-hmm.
And as you make the object, you discover the form it needs to follow.
Mm-hmm.
Yet you intuit it beforehand.
Mm-hmm.
However, to put the composition together as a unity, the mind must subordinate the theme-by-theme hearing to hearing the developmental process. So you hear this, and then you hear that, and you hear this. So we hear one quote by LaRouche, and another quote by LaRouche. That's theme-by-theme, and I'm trying to get you to hear the developmental process, or the form that's really underlying it,
mm-hmm.
the musical idea underlying it, the conceptual idea. The simple statement, and to make a simple statement about it is not enough. The simple statement corresponds to ordinary knowledge, the first level of simple hypothesis. The developmental process in a great musical composition corresponds at best to the higher hypothesis of Plato. That's the second level of the higher hypothesis, which generally gets bogged down in an Apollonian or Dionysian mode. Hence the difference between the master of existing musical knowledge, Johannes Brahms, and the creator of new musical knowledge. So Brahms is like an Aristotelian, an Aristotle. He can grasp all the existing encyclopedic categories of knowledge and play with them. But to create a whole new paradigm, which is going to be different from what the existing musical knowledge is, requires something else.
Mm-hmm.
That's the Promethean level, the third level, the hypothesis of the higher hypothesis. In other words, the hypothesis of something else besides the higher hypothesis you're operating with.
Yeah. Well, I'm thinking of like Einstein and other great thinkers and musicians who have said that, you know, they initiated a process within themselves because they were contemplating or working out a musical theme or a scientific idea or whatever, and then somehow the process started to take on life on of its own, and then all of a sudden the process delivered itself into the mind of the receiver as an illumination, as if it came from someplace else.
The preconscious.
Yeah, from the preconscious. The process took on a life of its own and then just developed itself within the preconscious and then delivered itself to the conscious mind of the musician or the scientist who had the ability to then write it down because he learned the language of being able to write it down in a form of an equation or writing the notes down on the page. But Aristotelian is trying to construct it, you know, one piece by one piece by one piece, and he's not initiating this process, which takes on a life of its own, which is creative in a truer sense than trying to put things together one piece at a time and construct something that way.
Right. And as you said all that, I think of the hypothesis of the higher hypothesis is, as something takes on a life of its own, and then you see where it leads, you then can think on another self-reflexive or another level and say, oh, now I can be aware of what was actually happening. And then you see the formula for how it did get there. You didn't know it when you were making it, but once it got there, you might be able to see a pattern. And then you start looking for those patterns around, and that'll move you into another preconscious kind of probing and exploring, and then you might have a more sophisticated result, or more advanced result. So it's the ongoing looking of the patterns of what apparently is taking on a life of its own, but it is, later, seen to be not taking a life of its own. It's following laws that you had not noticed yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you will get more awareness of the unconscious thing that seems to be taking a life of its own.
Right.
And then you don't say, well, we've arrived at a complete categorization
right.
of what happened. You know that that is leading you again into a place that seems to be taking on a life of its own.
So you're either discovering new laws that existed that you didn't know about, or new laws are being developed within the mind of the creator and then being discovered within the mind of the creator.
Yeah, but that sounds like getting trapped into subjectivity, so you'd have to have external processes to check the idea that you're getting only in your own illusion.
Right. But I wonder if there are ultimate laws to the cosmos, or as we investigate the cosmos and get involved in the creative process, new laws are born, which we then discover, and then we say, oh, look, that's the way it really works.
Right, and McLuhan says, well, let's look at the hidden ground. Maybe we can look at the technological environment that we didn't notice that made us think we discovered something.
Mm-hmm.
And it conformed to that pattern of the hidden ground.
Right.
McLuhan tends to then get you embedded in the sensory medium and looking at the forms of the medium. That's tricky. That tends towards the Aristotelian, whereas you don't want to get embedded in the Aristotelian contours of a medium,
right.
like McLuhan's analysis based on sensory characteristics. You need LaRouchean method to counter that. Now, McLuhan, if you read his books, you get understanding media, you get separate media. Those separate media don't exist anymore. So it actually has moved to a higher level that McLuhan's categories don't work in applying to the present.
Yeah, the laws of media that he discovered back when he was working with the Tetrad no longer apply. New laws have evolved out of the new ground.
Yeah. And so it would oscillate between... There is a truth that he's developing, and you apply them, but you don't get stuck in them. You also bring in the opposite school so that you're yourself in the interval. And this book is meant to put you in the interval between these five memes.
You know, it just occurred to me the laws of media may be as real as the laws of nature, but they actually didn't exist until we developed media. And
That's
then
right.
these new laws, almost laws of nature, came into being.
That's right. It becomes... interesting about what is physics.
Yeah.
Physics claims they're studying first nature, but they are always reflecting second nature.
Yeah.
And if first and second nature are more and more getting blurred, then that leads to a problem for physics, maybe.
Yeah.
We don't know what we're describing. I mean, Baudrillard, which would be a subset of the Croker part of the book, he says that most often physics, what we call physics, is a projection of the sociological effects of the social media.
Mm-hmm.
It's not even touching on first nature.
Yeah. But the Newtonian laws were not invalid because Einstein discovered relativity. They just fit within a larger matrix. And then relativity, when we discover how to travel interdimensionally, like the UFOs or whatever, that won't invalidate Einstein's laws of relativity. It'll just be embedded in a larger matrix.
Well, but the larger matrix comes from the technology. Newton was right for creating kinetic space and then landing on the moon. But we already land on the moon through electric media. When the camera takes us there, we get there faster than the rocket that took the camera to the moon.
Yeah.
Right? The discarnate state. But that's because we're in a new environment, which was human-made, the electronic environment. So Newton was a product of his technology, and Einstein is a product of his later technological
Well, situation. Newton's talking about getting the physicality of your body from here to there. When we go from here to there through the media, that's pure perception. There's no physical body involved.
That's right. Well, it's not just limited to the chemical body. And so when we moved into that electric era with the telegraph and telephone, new science evolved. Einstein, who tried to conceptualize old Gutenberg knowledge and adapt it to the new hidden effect.
See, the problem that I have with you equating actually traveling physically to the moon with getting to the moon through being able to witnessing it in the media, it's not the same. Sitting there watching the moon through your TV set is not the same as physically embodying walking on that surface and experiencing it firsthand. It's not the same. I don't know. You can't really equate the two.
Well, you're being an Aristotelian. You're asking me to experience a sensory environment and thinking that that will enhance my understanding, whereas if I conceptualize it from this advantageous situation of not having to sit in a rocket for a few days, which might blow up and then get stranded on the moon, I can conceptualize some of the data without having to physically get involved with being there.
Yeah, you can conceptualize the data, but you won't have the actual full-blown tactile experience of being there. I'm sure that Edgar Mitchell and Buzz Aldrin have a different perspective on the moon than you or I do, because they were there experienced it full body, full 100, 360 degree, all senses turned on at the same time. Whereas we witness an image through a television set.
They all suffered. A lot of astronauts had breakdowns.
Yeah.
In many ways.
Yeah.
Because they, as McLuhan said, the whole NASA program was a Newtonian program. It was obsolete to send humans out there. Why not send just the rockets out there or probes? The thing is, though, we're in the interval. We don't want to exaggerate the McLuhan point that